It's WKAR's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Welcome back. It's a Wednesday edition. Looking ahead to later in the week, tomorrow morning, off-the-record host Tim Skubick joins me, along with Kathy Gray of the Detroit Free Press, Zach Gorchow of Gonger News, for our August Month in Review segment, a good opportunity to revisit the most important state news stories, the ones worth knowing about in September and beyond. And do keep in mind, if you're attending the Jacksonville State season opener for the Michigan State Spartans Friday evening, look for us, Current State, live from Adams Field next to the Music Building. We're doing the program live between 6 and 7 on Friday night. John Madden will be by from the Spartan Marching Band, and we intend to yuck it up a bit from Adams Field before the game on Friday night. It's Wednesday here on Current State. To start our program today, after months of repercussions stemming from December's ice storm and power outages that affected thousands of its customers, the Lansing Board of Water and Light continues to generate headlines. Some customers complain of overly aggressive tree trimming by the city-owned utility. Others question the justification for a proposed rate hike. In June, the BWL board appeared to violate the state's Open Meetings Act. Meanwhile, the utility moves ahead on dozens of reforms suggested in various performance reviews on its outage management system, communication practices, tree trimming, and revised governance. For his views on these important matters and to update progress on reforms at the utility, we welcome Board of Water and Light General Manager J. Peter Lark.
Good morning, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Welcome to Current State. We appreciate your being here. Since it's been in the news a lot recently, let's start with the tree trimming discussion. Some BWL customers, mainly in East Lansing, it appears, have been complaining recently that tree trimming has been too aggressive, that there's been cutting that wasn't necessary. Is that still a topic of discussion between the utility and its customers?
Well, I think, yes, it is, Mark. You know, we have been doing a lot more tree trimming than we have ever done before. As I've said before, the Board of Water and Light is a different utility than it was a year ago. And one of the things we used to do a year ago was we would operate 4 or 5 tree trimming crews throughout our region. Since the
year-round.
Year-round. Okay. Year-round, day in, day out, every month, we'd have 4 or 5 crews working. And at the time, that seemed to be the optimum amount or optimal amount. However, since the outage, we've been reviewed by a number of outfits, including ourselves, the community review team that's called the CRT, as well as the Public Service Commission. And all three of those entities, particularly the CRT and the PSC, made it clear that we had to be a little bit more aggressive with our tree trimming. And aggressive might be the wrong word, but ambitious. We had to get the job done a little more thoroughly. We had to take out overhanging limbs, which we hadn't been doing in the past. So what we've been doing really now is, instead of running 4 or 5 crews, we're now running between, depending on how many people are in the truck, between 14 and 18 crews. So Since January or February, we've been really trying to get at those overhanging limbs. You probably don't know it, but during the outage, we had 2,500 lines down. You know, we lost 40% of our system, our distribution system, the most any utility has ever lost. But with 2,500 lines down, you can imagine how much time it took those. I'm sure you well know that it took a long time to get a lot of those lines back. And I think one of the fascinating features or stats is that of those 2,500 lines, do you know how many of those were taken down by tree limbs? Mark, take a guess.
I do not know.
Well, all 2,500. Okay. So our lines are what we call heavy. They meet the heavy standards, which means they'll take a 1/2 inch of ice without going down, even in a windstorm. So the wind didn't knock our lines down. What knocked
trees
the lines
did.
Down were tree trims. And I think that's tree limbs. And I think that's probably no surprise to customers. So Mother Nature has done a lot of tree trimming for us back in the area of December 22nd. But we still have a lot to do. And we've been doing that since January or February.
Well, let's hear from one of those East Lansing residents here. Devin Glass says he has a 75-foot tall pine tree on his property. He complains of both a lack of notice and overly aggressive cutting. Here he is.
It's on my property. I was never notified that it was going to be cut. It also concerns me because the power line that it interfered would not have impacted anyone other than my neighbors. And instead of asking me or my neighbor whether we wanted to cut the tree or do something else, they simply cut the tree. They came onto my property, they cut the tree. They never provided me notice that they were going to cut the tree, and they never allowed me the chance to discuss whether or not that was something that was reasonable.
Peter, how are you responding to customers like Devin?
Well, first of all, we understand that many customers really enjoy their trees, although you'd be surprised. We have many customers who call us, and they really enjoy their electricity. So I think when you talk about the clip that you just ran, we make every effort to make sure that every customer knows what we're up to. By that, I mean what we do is we send out a letter to everybody in that area where we're going to cut trees. Not everybody whose home is going to be affected, but everybody in the neighborhood gets a letter from us. We also have a door hanger that we put on everyone's house whose tree is going to be cut so that they know their tree is going to be cut.
And any idea why he didn't know about this?
No, I have no idea. Because in addition to that, we meet with neighborhood groups. We meet with every single neighborhood group before we go tree cutting. And furthermore, we have a website. And on our website, we list all the places, not only where we are trimming, but where we intend to trim or where we're going to be trimming in the near future. The other thing I think, Mark, that our listeners have to understand from our point of view is that this is really a public safety issue. So I understand perfectly well why customers don't want their trees trimmed. That's perfectly understandable. But on the other hand, we're talking secondary and primary lines that run behind their homes. And those lines can affect 10 people, 100 people, even 1,000 people downline from that customer. So while that customer wants his or her tree to remain, there are people 1,000 homes down from that line, maybe 10 homes, maybe 50, maybe up to 1,000, that have infants in them, that have infirm people, that have elderly people in them. So it's a safety issue. A lot of people have medical conditions that, in fact, require electricity to operate those. And I just want to say as well, too, and I know you want to get a word in, Mark, and of course I'll let you, it's your show, but it's a public safety issue in more ways than just that, because when that wire comes down, there are residents that can be walking around in that vicinity, and they can suffer serious consequences if they interact with that wire.
Have you been more accommodating in the past regarding tree trimming, though? I mean, was there more is there less dialogue now with homeowners over what comes down and what doesn't come down than there has been in the past?
No, Mark. There is more dialogue now than ever before. In fact, I've told my tree trimming people to make sure that if anyone objects to any of our tree trimming, that they back off, come back to the office, and work it through and make sure we know exactly what we're doing and we meet specifically with that customer. To make sure that the customer knows exactly what we are doing.
There's a new BWL board president, David Price. Do you expect your working relationship with the board to change with Mr. Price in that position?
Yes, I do.
How?
Well, I don't know exactly yet. I can give you a couple of examples, but really our prior chair, Sandy Zirkle, I think did a very good job for 4 or 5 years. And so you get kind of used to or accustomed to the way she operates the board. And of course, I think that's one of the purposes why we try to alternate chairs every now and again to make sure every board member gets an opportunity to get his or her views across to the entire board and the Board of Water and Light as to how the BWL should operate. So I'm looking forward to David's leadership. I think David has a different style than Sandy did, and I'm not saying a better style. I'm saying a different style. And the hope is that when we have different chairs, we have different styles, and they all come together, they complement each other, and we have a better BWL for all of our customers.
He says he wants the board to review the utility's employee evaluation and contract process. Do you expect to be under greater scrutiny with David Price at the top of the board?
Boy, that's hard to say. Let me put it this way. I'm under, I'll say, a definite level of scrutiny by all eight of my board members. And I think, Mark, that's as it should be. So, you know, we have meetings where discussions take place about the evaluation of the performance, the evaluation and the performance of the general manager, me. And I'd like to say sometimes those evaluations and meetings work very well. Sometimes the board makes it clear that there are some areas that we can improve in. So I don't really expect a different level. I know that our new chair will make sure that the BWL is operating as well as it should be and is a great utility for the for all of its customers. And I think that the past chair did the same thing. But I think there'll be probably a different level of operation with the new chair than there was with the old chair, as is only normal. And I would expect several years from now, when Chairman Price is no longer the chair, there'll be a whole different level of scrutiny with the new chair. And I think that's a good thing. I think change is a good thing. It keeps all of us on our toes. The idea is we've been trying to make the BWL a much better utility, actually, since I've been here, but particularly since December 22nd with respect to some of the communications and operational issues we've had. And I think every time you bring a new chair in to take a little closer look at things, that can only be good.
We're talking with Peter Larkt, General Manager of the Lansing Board of Water and Light. Let's talk about some of the many reforms that the utility has embarked on. There were well over 100 contained in all of the reviews that were done. You had you performed an internal review. There was the Public Service Commission, and there was the Community Review Team, the CRT. Most recently, you announced a new app, and you had a chance to put it into practice yesterday here, in just a matter of hours ago. What is this app about?
Well, first of all, the app is a great thing, and I'm finding, to show you how great it is, the news media is using it a lot, too, and you'll see it sometimes on the TVs. They will run our app to show where there are outages. What it is it's an app, it's free, and it's available at the Apple or Android stores. I recommend everyone in the BWL territory get it. I'm looking at my iPhone right in front of me. I can touch that button, and within 5 seconds, I can tell you how many outages we have. And if you, for the particular customer, of course, they've got to log in their own personal data. They can find out what's going on at their own home. So you can bring that up within seconds, and you will see next to the icon where your home is, an icon saying, do you wish to report an outage? All you have to do is hit that button, and you've reported an outage. You can look through by census tract where there are other outages that don't involve your particular house. It'll tell you times of restoration. So this is another great avenue by which our customers can communicate with us and tell us they have an outage, and they can also learn more information as to when the restoration is going to take place. And finally, they can learn if power comes back on.
What about the larger outage management system? Because this got a lot of attention in the CRT report. It wasn't working during the ice storm. Its problems were cited by the CRT. What about the larger system?
Yes, we call it the Outage Management System, the OMS. That now has been stress tested to handle 100% of our to handle the BWL losing 100% of our customers. I don't think that's ever going to happen in our time. I'm hoping we lost 40% of our customers, which was the largest any utility has ever lost in Michigan. But it has now been stress tested and repeatedly to make sure that it is operating, and that in fact, even if we lost all of our customers, the outage management system, or what we call the OMS, would work satisfactorily.
So if an ice storm happened tomorrow, would the BWL be able to produce an accurate, up-to-date outage map?
Absolutely. And it would produce it in a number of places, one of which is our website. But more importantly, it's this mobile app that I'm holding up right now. Honestly, this app gives us a third way for customers to get into our system. We have the 877 number. We have the website. We have this app. And I'll give you a little bit of breaking news, Mark. In the next few weeks, we're going to announce a text service to get into the BWL. So after reviewing all of the utilities in the United States, all of the utilities in the United States, we are going to be among only a handful that have four ways in which a customer can get into the BWL. It's really something super.
A few weeks ago, Lansing City Council President Aileen Bowles told our listeners that a rate hike has been approved and will be in the BWL's 2015 budget. Is a rate hike a done deal?
Absolutely not. Mark, I am recommending, and my staff at the BWL is recommending to our board, our commissioners, that we have a rate increase. However, there will be, I believe, three more hearings between now and then before that is a done deal. And as I'm sure you know, Mark, but just so your listeners know, Peter Lark does not set the rates at the BWL.
I know. This involves the board.
Right. Not only involves them, I can give them suggestions. They'll make the decision. So probably, I think, three more hearings yet to go, and we expect to have customer input. We've always had customer input, but we haven't had a rate increase, a base rate increase. This is the third year. There have been cost of living adjustments that have had to be made by the BWL, not to mention storm hardening. So a lot of the things we've done, all this tree trimming, the 14 to 18 crews rather than 4 to 5, that costs money. The hiring of additional line crew, the customer service representatives, the social media experts, and the other people we've hired costs money. So some of this costs money. I expect for the average residential customer, that'll be about $2.50 a month, or I like to say 8 cents a day.
This got real confusing, though, because Aileen Bowles said the public hearing on the rate hike, as you said, there are three more public hearings still scheduled on this, but she insisted that the budget process actually preceded the hearings. The cart was before the horse, so to speak, and that the rate increase has already been approved. You're saying that's not the case.
Well, it's absolutely not the case that the rate increase has been approved. But I think, Mark, what she's referring to, and of course I didn't hear the comments, I don't believe, but when we put together a budget for the next year, we try to attempt to figure, is there going to be a rate increase or is there not going to be a rate increase? We assumed that there would be a rate increase, so we added a number in there for a rate increase in our budget. So yes, and the budget has been approved, but that does not mean the rate increase has been approved. And I can tell you, this is my eighth year here, and I've gone through a number of rate increase requests, and I can't tell you for sure, but pretty much anecdotally, very rarely are the rate recommendations that I propose accepted exactly as I propose them. But still, for budgeting purposes, we have to figure out in the next year, what do we expect our revenues will be?
She also suggested here, and again, we're talking about Lansing City Council President Aileen Bowles, she also suggested here that the rate hike that has been proposed is inappropriate. She claimed that the various reviews of the utility's performance following the ice storm recommended, she said, 168 different reforms, that about 100 of them had begun, and that it would be a long time before they were all acted on. Here's how she concluded.
Before you ever have the conversation or discussion as a board about a rate increase, you would want to rebuild that trust and fill the gap that exists right now between what happened and moving forward.
So she argues that any rate hike is extremely premature under these circumstances. You would maintain it's not.
Well, I would maintain that that'll be a question for the board to make a determination. You know, we do have probably $5 million in storm hardening expenses. And as far as getting the word out to customers, you know, that's one of the reasons I'm here. We've done an epic MRA poll, and we've indicated to our in the poll, we've asked the customers questions about, are the things we've done operationally and communications-wise the sorts of things that customers want? And the number is 93%. So,
But does that equate to a rate hike? Does that mean they're willing to undergo a rate hike with any memories of the power outages and all the other drama following the ice storm?
Well, what it means is they're very, very supportive of the kinds of changes we've made. And I've indicated to you that these changes are not they do not come inexpensively. They cost money. And so that's one part of the rate increase, but that's not the whole entirety of the rate increase. We also need more money because it's been several years since we've had a rate increase. We have a lot of infrastructure at the BWL that depreciates as the years go on and that have to be replaced. We have a return on equity that we pay to the city that has gone up from 4 to 5 to 6.1%. All of these things cost money for the Board of Water and Light.
Last month, it appears that your contract was reapproved, apparently in violation of the State Open Meetings Act. Discussions were mainly limited to phone calls and emails. I've got to ask you about this. How does it feel to know that your contract got extended in that way? What's your perspective on this?
Well, Mark, I'm smiling only a little bit because this is one of those things where I'm not sure the media quite has it right, because my contract wasn't extended. In fact, my contract wasn't altered at all. My contract was entered into a year ago, so I don't, maybe 15 months ago at this point. So it wasn't the subject of any of those, the Open Meetings Act questions or issues that are swirling around, or that were swirling around the BWL at one time. I don't know, because I can't speak for my board and exactly what they did, but there was no new contract for me or different contract or change to my contract. All that was done with respect to my appointment was that under the city charter, every year I have to be reappointed by the board, and the board did reappoint me.
Okay, so that is the word you would use, is you were reappointed by the board.
Well, that is what happened.
Right, but and that is not subject to the provisions of the State's Open Meeting Act, any discussions involving a reappointment?
Well, again, we're getting into legal matters that I don't know if I'm that equipped to answer, but I would say that my reappointment was done totally in public at a board meeting, and the reappointment that I would say could not have violated the Open Meetings Act. That's just me. But you'd have to talk to somebody else, because I'm not really familiar with that argument.
You know, the board has been an awful lot more in the news lately due to incidents like what I just brought up. How have these recent incidents involving the board affected your ability to do your job?
Well, it's funny. I occasionally get that question, Mark, but before I had this job, I was the chairman of the Public Service Commission. And before that, I was the state's utility consumer advocate. And before that, I was just a plain old lawyer. So I'm not really a stranger to people disagreeing with my positions. Let me say this. It's never good. You want the BWL, the company I represent, to always have the highest reputation. And when you don't see it having the finest reputation, it's somewhat dispiriting. But you ask me about me personally. What I try to do in the morning is I get up and I put my clothes on every day, and I put a smile on my face and go into work and try to do the very best job I can for all of my customers.
What are your interactions like with your customers, you know, person to person? What have they been like lately?
I think the interactions have largely been very positive person to person with customers. I have been out, for example, at one of the customers that we had a problem with when it comes to tree trimming out in East Lansing. And I don't recall her name, but we went and toured her property, and I thought it was very positive, and I think we came to a very good resolution. In fact, that's what we're trying to do, Mark. We're trying to come to resolutions with all of these customers and working hard to satisfy what they want accomplished when it comes to tree trimming. And hopefully there's a way that they can meet their goal of the aesthetic aspect that they're interested in at their home. And hopefully we can meet our goal of following what the CRT and the PSC, Community Review Team and the Public Service Commission, have so clearly told us that we have to do.
I'll point out that East Lansing Mayor Nathan Triplett is apparently listening to the program here today, and he just texted us that he still characterizes the notice, tweeted that the notice given by the utility he would describe as inadequate. That is his word. And any response to that you haven't made clear already?
Well, I have a great deal of respect for Mayor Triplett. And if there is another way that we could give notice to him, I'd certainly like to hear about it. As I've said, when it comes to any customer who has a problem with the BWL's tree trimming practices, we are more than happy to come out. Our arborists, as well as the leaders of our tree trimmers, come out and discuss all of these problems or any of these problems with any of the customers. And as I said, Mark, try to work out some arrangement whereby their aesthetic sensibilities are taken care of, while the public good, the public service, the public safety issues that are so important here are also satisfied.
You were under a lot of pressure to resign. You have been under a lot of pressure to resign. Did you ever come close to resigning?
No, Mark. It's pretty much what I said earlier. You know, what I've said earlier, both today and at other places. I look at the job of a CEO as sort of like find problems, fix them, and make sure they don't happen again. That's what I enjoy doing. That's why I enjoy my job. You know, I used to work for Governor Granholm, and I remember when things would get a little dicey there, she would say, don't look at these things as problems or obstacles. Look at them as opportunities. And that's really what I've done. As I've said before, I'm repeating myself a little bit, but these are problems. These are obstacles. They're things that need to be solved. That's what you need a good CEO for, and that's what I do. As I said, every morning I put my clothes on, put a smile on my face, go into the BWL, and try to make it a better place.
The snow and ice storm season returns in a few months. Are you personally confident that the Board of Water and Light will respond adequately and professionally if another ice storm were to wipe out power to thousands of your customers?
Absolutely. We are a completely different utility when it comes to operationally answering storms like that and communication-wise. Now, again, this was the largest storm that's ever hit a utility. We're the only utility to ever lose 40% of our lines. That's a major storm. I have to be honest with you, Mark. I'm not expecting that again. I've been through a number of outages since I started about 7 or 8 years ago here. But if we should have another one of the magnitude we did before, you will see the BWL being a completely different utility, handling the outage in a much better way, getting power back to customers more quickly. That's the design, getting power back to customers more quickly. And we can do that now. But, you know, also as important as that, Mark, is the communications. We now have the ability to have our customers call us or contact us within seconds, and they're going to get information back from us within seconds. And the information won't be able to tell them that very minute that you'll be back in 30 minutes. But it will give you a default time, and then when we send a crew out, the crew will be able to determine, well, that's a three-hour fix. We will put that on our website. We will put that on our mobile app, so a customer will know exactly what's going on. They'll know they're out. They'll know it's coming back in a certain amount of time, and also we'll be able to tell them, particularly if they have that app, it's so easy, exactly when the power comes back. So no or yes, in answer to your question, we're a different utility. We're better prepared operationally in communications for the next outage, and we will do a better job for our customers.
Peter Lark is the general manager of Lansing's Board of Water and Light. Many thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Mark. Always good to see you.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. 160 years ago, the U.S. government agreed to land rights with Michigan's Ojibwe people after discussions in Washington, D.C. The Ojibwe delegation was led by 93-year-old Chief Buffalo, who traveled with the group from Lake Superior to negotiations in the nation's capital. The story of Chief Buffalo was recently told to Lake Superior magazine editor Connie LeMay. WKAR's Peter Worf spoke with LeMay by phone about the Ojibwe leader's remarkable journey.
Chief Buffalo is one of the outstanding figures that needs to be remembered in general because of what he was able to do and negotiate for his people. He was a chief in the area around the Madeline Island communities. And what was happening is the thing that makes some of the treaty and some of the history with the Ojibwe so tragic is that they weren't fighting and they weren't attacking the European settlers. They were cooperating and trying to incorporate, even though it was difficult, into the changes that were happening. And so they had made a series of treaties outlining land areas and areas that they would also retain and rights that they would retain. They were very savvy negotiators and retained certain rights even in areas that no longer would be under their direct control. But then for some reason, President Zachary Taylor in 1850 did a removal order wanting to remove the Ojibwe people from the Lake Superior region. And anyone who knows the history of Native peoples in the area knows that there were these massive removals, the Trail of Tears to moving the tribes from the western parts of the country into Oklahoma, these mass migrations, forced migrations, and this is what was facing the Ojibwe people.
Connie, let's talk a little bit about what came to be known as the Sandy Lake tragedy.
After that removal order, one of the things that was done in order to try to remove, to expedite the removal, is in earlier treaties, among the negotiations were certain annuities. They would call each year there were material goods and actual cash payments that were to be given out to the tribes and then divided. And this was not charity, or this was not this was because in fact the economy of the nation was changing. The treaties were making it so that their economy, which was based on hunting and gathering, was having to be changed into a more sedentary and less broad-ranged. You need a large range of territory to feed people if you're doing it through hunting and gathering. And because that territory was being reduced and they were willingly allowing settlement of Europeans into their region, the treaties included payments and annuities that would help transition the economy of the people. Well, those annuities had always been, those payments had always been made on Madeline Island, which was kind of a center hub for people, and it made a lot of sense that it would be there. Well, in order to expedite the removal, they changed the place to a place actually kind of southwest of Duluth, Minnesota, well away from Lake Superior, and they did it late in the year, hoping that they would essentially trap the Ojibwe people there, that they would not be able to come back to their homelands during the winter months, and that they would therefore remove them from Lake Superior, essentially de facto removing them, because a lot of people had to come to get the goods that they were owed through the treaty. Well, they made delays and delays while they were here. Lots of people ended up getting diseases within that community and dying of that. But then also when the payments finally came through late in fall, actually early in winter, there was then the migration back. They did not want to stay in this place. And already people had been dying because of illnesses, because it was not a good place to be. And so they migrated back home, and there were many people who died along that route as well. And there are estimates as high as 400 people dying between the area there and then returning home. And it really is a black blot, I think, on the U.S. government that they would do this purposefully. They were trying to get subvert so that people would have to come away from their homelands.
That became known as the Sandy Lake tragedy. I'm speaking with Connie LeMay of Lake Superior Magazine. She's the editor. We're talking about Ojibwe Chief Buffalo on Current State today. Okay, so Connie, there was this intentional movement of people and misdirection of funding. to the suffering of the Ojibwe people. What was their next move?
It was decided that a group of Ojibwe people would go to Washington, D.C. and try to plead the case and stop this removal. It was led by Chief Buffalo. Now, Chief Buffalo at the time was 93 years old,
yeah.
And yet he was considered a good speaker and a good negotiator, and so he agreed to undertake this journey. So starting out from La Pointe in a canoe, they traveled east and along the way traveled by canoe. And there were six delegates who were Ojibwe and then one, Benjamin Armstrong, who was the interpreter and also was married to a woman from the Ojibwe tribe. And so he was the interpreter for them. They traveled by canoe, by steamership, by train, and after many months were able to get to Washington, D.C. Then when they got there, they first, of course, encountered the lower-level bureaucrats, mostly in the Office of Indian Affairs, who were very dismissive and essentially told them, go home, you weren't invited here, you don't have permission to come, you have to go back to where you came from. And that was, of course, not what they were going to do. They wanted to be able to plead their case. But as it turned out, there was a serendipitous happening in that the hotel that they were staying at, people were fascinated by these people, both because they came from such a far distance from Lake Superior, but also because they were Ojibwe, a culture nobody in the East really knew of. And so at the hotel, they ended up being invited to eat in the dining room. And when they were in there, there were many members of the cabinet of the president, who was Lord Fillmore. And the cabinet members then began to talk to them and realized, hey, something's, you know, they need to be able to see the president. And so actually through that, they were able to get an audience with President Fillmore, were able to plead their case. They had created a special pipe of peace and were able to actually smoke and do a ceremony with him, pleaded their case. And I should say that all along the route, as they were coming by canoe and by train and by steamership, they were stopping in places like the Upper Peninsula and gathering signatures on a petition from non-Indian people saying, we don't understand why there's a removal. We like the Ojibwe people as our neighbors. They've been good neighbors and they've been good community members, so we oppose the removal order. So between the negotiating and the petitions that they brought, they were able to secure Fillmore's promise that he did, in fact, he rescinded that removal order and then requested another treaty, which was the Treaty of 1854. Now, that opened up lands in Minnesota, essentially in Minnesota's North Shore and many places in Wisconsin and Michigan, but it also retained hunting, gathering, and other rights to specific areas in the broader ceded territories. Those are the ones, the fishing rights that came up many decades or centuries later, retaining fishing and hunting rights, and then also created these reservations or areas that were to remain tribal homeland. It's an amazing story for a man who in his 90s made this incredible trip in order to save his people from being removed from their sacred homeland.
The incredible story of Ojibwe Chief Buffalo told to us in the latest issue of Lake Superior Magazine by its editor, Connie LeMay. Connie, thanks a lot.
Oh, thanks so much, Peter.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
Current State, Mid-Michigan's meeting place for the informed, the caring, and the curious. Next time you're listening online, visit and like our Facebook page, please, at facebook.com/currentstate, and you can follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Wednesday and time for our Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. Today, Current State features the Next Step program at Peckham, the vocational rehabilitation nonprofit. The program offers individualized services and support for 18 to 21-year-olds who have a prior juvenile record. Here to tell us more about Peckham's Next Step program, Daryl Malik, who's a transition specialist for the program. Hi, Daryl.
Hi.
And joining Daryl is one of the program's participants, Amanda Morris. Hi, Amanda. Welcome to Current State. Tell us more about the Next Step program here, Daryl. Who does it serve exactly?
Like you had said, it serves 18 to 21-year-olds in the Lansing community that had a previous juvenile record, but a clean adult record. So that's our target population. We've been in existence for about 2 years now. And the program, a couple of the major components of the program, is basically when they come in, it's individualized based on the needs of the participant, but a few of the main components are a GED component. We have GED teachers in case they haven't graduated from high school. We also have another part of the program that's called Work Track, where they develop a portfolio, which includes resumes, cover letters, basically anything that they would need once they went out to go into an interview to obtain a job. And also along with that, we also encourage them to try to obtain some type of industry-wide recognized credential, whether it's CDL or construction or CNA, in order for them to actually go out there and have a stable job and source of living as well, too.
How do you assess each participant's needs and goals? How do you work that out?
Well, as a transition specialist, it's myself and another one. We actually sit down with them within a month of when they join the program after we've got to know the participants a little bit and what their needs are and what kind of their desire is to get out of the program. And we have an individualized development plan. And we basically set three or four goals for them over the course of 3 months. And then we always revisit those goals after 3 months to see if they achieve those goals or if they still need to work on those goals as well, too.
How long can participants stay in the program, and what are the requirements to stay in the program?
They basically just have to be self-motivated. I mean, we've had some participants that stay 2 or 3 months. You know, they get their GED, they know what they want to do with their life, and they, you know, breeze through the program. You know, there's other participants that just need a little bit more time to have an idea and a feel for what they want to do with their life. So we've had a few participants that stay up to 9 months to a year as well, too. So like I said, it's just on an individualized basis.
Amanda, tell us a little bit about your story here. What was your situation before you started participating in Next Step?
Well, I was referred to Next Step back when I was 17, and I was I was getting out of a probation school. It took me a year or two to get into the program. When I felt like I was ready, that's when I applied, and I got in the Next Step program March of this year. And that's basically it. I've been going. I'm motivated. I graduate today. It's just a good program.
You graduate today?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Wow. Are you from this area?
No.
Okay. And did you? So you didn't go to high school around?
Well, I did, but mainly probation schools like Ingham Academy, Crossroads.
How did you find it? You found out about the Next Step program, how?
They dropped me off probation and they referred me to Next Step.
Is that typical, how participants find out about the Next Step program, Daryl?
Yeah, we do get a lot of referrals from JCOs and POs from the court as well. But a lot of it is also just word of mouth, you know, or, you know, we've had some PSAs on radio stations as well. So we just try to draw from a lot of different avenues. But yeah, a lot of our participants have been referred from the court system once they're off of probation.
And Amanda, tell us a little bit more about what you've been working on.
I've just been working on, like, you know, how to stay motivated, how to build a better for myself and my son. This program's helped me a lot because they help you whenever you need something. If you're struggling, they're there.
Do you think about your future more since you've been participating in this? I mean, Does the program create an orientation toward the future?
Yes.
Okay. It sounds like it. Yeah. What's been the most challenging thing for you, Amanda?
I would say just having the motivation to wake up every day and go, because I never liked school, and, you know, I have a son, so I felt like I needed to get an education.
What do you like about the program?
Just all the opportunities they have to offer, and it's just a good program and all. Like, there's really nothing not to like about it, but I like everything about it.
Is it a big, how many do you serve, Daryl?
Over the course of the last 2 years, we've served over 100 participants. And over 60% of the ones that we've served have obtained full-time employment or have enrolled in college when they're done. And then 50% of our students have attained their high school diploma or GED or other some kind of industry-wide recognized credential, like I was saying as well, too. And I forgot to say, one of the other major components of our grant is the fact that we have a give-back program. That's something that's not required, but it's offered, where twice a week the participants go out into the community and they volunteer at different locations. And the whole purpose of that is because when they were charged with whatever crime it was, whether it was a misdemeanor, whatever it was, they offended the community in some way. And this is kind of their way of being able to give back to the community and to see that appreciation for being a positive example and a positive participant in the community as well, too. And it's something that has been a very, very beneficial component, especially for the participants. Mm. So.
We're talking with Daryl Malik of Peckham's Next Step program. He's a transition specialist with the program. Also, Amanda Morris, who is one of the program's participants. There is a volunteer component to Next Step as well, Daryl. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, we obviously have our staff in place and everything, but serving 100 participants that have individual needs, we're always looking for people that could volunteer in the program. We've had quite a few people actually from Peckham, because Youth Services is just one entity of Peckham, but we've had people from Peckham that tutor in math and reading, and then we've also had some people that have also helped out with, you know, like taking people on for like paid internships, which we would actually pay for a few weeks to see if it might be a good fit for our participants and everything. So it's basically any way that people can get involved based on the needs of our participants. We're more than willing to accept their help on a volunteer basis.
Amanda, Daryl was talking about participants giving back to the community. Mm-hmm. How have you been doing that?
Well, I go to the give backs mostly every week, and I just like going. My favorite place is the VOA, because I see people walking around that are less fortunate. Excuse me. And it makes me think that I don't have, like, you know, when I see people that are less fortunate or like are down and out, it makes it like, when I think about myself, when I get down and out, and when I see them, it just motivates me that I should be grateful for what I have, you know? And I just love talking to people, see how their day is going. So,
How do other participants, respond to the give-back component here, Daryl? What does it do for them? Is Amanda's experience typical?
Yeah, it's very typical. I mean, for the most part, they come away from those experiences wanting more, wanting to have other opportunities to volunteer, not just at the VOA, but Amanda even went yesterday to deliver mattresses to people that were in need as well, too. So for the most part, I mean, the participants in the program really see it as a way to get more in touch with the community. And then sometimes it actually helps them understand what they want to do in the future as well, too. If they interact with these people, you know, we have one person that's going to school to be a social worker as well, too, after volunteering at the VOA and some other places. So for the most part, it's been a very, very positive experience.
Where does your funding come from?
The funding actually comes from the Department of Labor. It's a two-year grant plus 3 months of startup and follow-up. And we're actually in the phase right now where the grant is ending. And unless something else comes up from the Department of Labor over the next 6 months, it ends in December. So we're really at the point right now. We feel like there's such a need in the community. I know that there's other people that feel a need in the community. We were actually one of many organizations that applied for this grant across the country and one of very few that actually got the grant, and I think that's because the Department of Labor, the government, recognized that there was a need in this community to serve at-risk youth and try to curb that whole pipeline from school to prison as well, too. So we're kind of at the end of that phase, but unless we find other funding, then it's probably going to end in December, which is obviously something that we don't want, the participants don't want, and hopefully the community doesn't want. So we're always looking for organizations or people that feel like there's a need in that community to maybe contribute in order for this program to continue as well, too.
Amanda, tell us about your longer-term plan. Once you finish with the Next Step program, what do you want to be doing?
I plan on going to college to become an X-ray technician.
Okay. And if you weren't involved in the program, where do you think you'd be right now in your life?
Probably still sitting at home.
Okay. Well, it's been a pleasure to learn about the Next Step program here at Peckham. Here in Lansing, we want to thank our guest, Daryl Malik, is a transition specialist for Peckham's Next Step program. Amanda Morris is one of the program's participants. Many thanks to both of you. Good luck to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Current State could always use more nominations, and we know there are people and organizations out there that are doing excellent work, but we just don't know about them. Please help us out and tweet us suggestions at KAR Current State, or send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put neighbors in action in the subject line, I beg your pardon, and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work that they do. That's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, we have our August Month in Review Roundtable with journalist Kathy Gray of the Free Press, Zach Gorchow from Gongwer, and Off the Record's Tim Skubick. That and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer, thanks to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also to Aaron Young for engineering. We're glad you could join us. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.